Successful people learn how to make their mind work for them. I'm David Nagel, and this is the Successful Mind Podcast.
Hey everyone, this is BT and welcome to Inside the Episode. David and I are about to have a spirited discussion around the effect of thought on circumstances, how people complain about success.
I think
we agree, and I think we might disagree a little bit here, but this is going to be good. So in this particular episode, you started off right out of the gate with a letter from Frank Sinatra that he wrote in 1990 to, in essence, it was to George Michael, that was actually published in the newspaper relating to an article called The Reluctant Pop Star that was George Michael was featured in. So this is where it's going to get interesting, because you can look at this in a couple of different ways, right? So my generation, I didn't know much about Frank Sinatra, honestly. By the time, I mean, he was still very popular, was still touring, was still doing all this sort of stuff. But he was 74 when he wrote this letter to in the paper to George Michael, basically calling him out and, for all intents and purposes, bitch slapping
him. He was bitch slapping him. He was. He was totally being a bitch.
He totally was. So he basically, you can look at this one of two ways. He's either, you know, calling him out because the limelight has not faded completely, but it's flickering, and George Michael is maybe at the top of his game. So he wants to knock him down a peg, and he's taking the time to come down on him hard and be like, look, pal, this is, you got to be doing better than this. Or he's trying to motivate him, to empower him, to see that success is something that should be celebrated and not complained about. I got it as the get off my lawn guy. You saw it completely different.
Completely,
so I want to have a conversation around that.
Yeah, completely different.
So what do you think? So I guess
here's the thing. I don't see where he's trying to knock him down a peg. I think he's trying to pick him up. He basically states, he states the problem, and then in the third paragraph, he says, come on, George, loosen up, swing man. Like, and like, take, I mean, yes, he's using old language, right?
No, I got
it's you. Not even my generation, your generation, it's totally. Like our grandparents' generation. But what he's saying really is true. Like, you know, it is a lot of hard work, but you look at it for what it actually is. And at the end, he's like, because here's what he says at the end. He said, those who have talent need to hug it, embrace it, nurture it, and share it. At least it not be taken away from you as fast as it was loaned. So he's telling him to have some respect for the fact that this guy's got a God-given talent. I mean, George Michael was huge. I mean, the guy was a gorgeous singer, right? Beautiful man, beautiful voice. People loved him all over the world. And yeah, he had problems, but not like any different than anybody else has problems. And I think he was trying to put it in perspective. Like, you could have a hell of a lot worse problems of being on top of the world as a pop star, which you've wanted since you were a kid, and now you're going to complain about it, you know?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, well, and you know, I'm not a pop star, and I don't know what a person must go through and how many people have to be, you know, take a piece of this, take a piece of that. They're always on you. I just thought that it was interesting. And it was probably the language that sort of triggered me out of the gate. It was like, you know, he's saying like gossamer wings. Right. I better Google it. I have no freaking clue. And then he's got Fly Yourself to the Moon, which of course is one of his songs. Yeah. I'm like, come on, Frank. This is so crazy to me. But
I think it's a little tongue-in-cheek too, don't
you? I think so. It must be cheeky. But here's the thing. This is what got me, is that I was a, you know, child of the 80s in high school in the 90s. So I was kind of like that maybe rebellious teen at age 16, he's coming out and shooting this, you know, this sort of, you know, words towards George Michael. And I'm not a huge George Michael fan. I don't want to feel like I'm defending him here or anything, but it's sort of like the way he went about it.
But you're not a huge Frank Sinatra fan either.
Yeah, I mean, I'm real, because I didn't know him. Like, honestly, like I said, before we came on to tape, you know, Frank Sinatra was a spoof by the time I got in there, even though he was still touring. And I went through his discography while you were going through this. Yeah. And I was trying to create an argument that I was going to have with you about why this guy is out of line. And really, he wasn't out of line. I mean, he did work his ass off, and he went through many iterations. And he was born in 1915, and he didn't die until like 98. And he was still touring up until he was like you know, 1996.
80. Like, yeah, I think it was 82 and 98,
totally.
Right?
And his greatest selling album happened in 93.
There you
go. Which is crazy, right? His duets album went to the moon, baby. Yeah. So it was just really interesting to me to see how he was really coming out strong here. And I think the language in there kind of got me. And I like how he brings in the tragedy of fame, because that's really what this was about. I have a feeling that George Michael, he probably got to a point where he was freaking done with it all. But once you open up that box, you can't close it up. Once you are that famous guy, people want a piece of you and they're going to want more of you. And he probably was just freaking tired. The guy died when he was like 53 years old. You know, George Michael.
Oh, he had a ton of demons.
Totally.
Oh, he had a ton of demons.
Totally.
Yeah.
And I need to look at it from a mentorship standpoint and be like, look, but it's interesting that it ends up in the paper, right? I think that was another piece. Like, if you really wanted to say something, why don't you reach out to George? And maybe he did. But the fact that he put it in the paper to me was like, and I hate being this guy, but it's like, why did he do that? And we'll never know. We'll never know.
No. We'll never know what this, I mean, there may have been pre-story around this that we don't know. Like who knows? So when I see something like this, when I thought about it, what I think is interesting, and nobody would really know this, like you have to read a couple of biographies about Frank Sinatra. It's not like Frank didn't have his demons.
Sure.
He had big
sure.
demons. But the difference that Frank was coming from was that he owned him. He owned him. He didn't apologize
yes.
for who he was, right? He was a huge womanizer. He was a huge boozer, huge smoker. He hung around gangsters. Like, he did not apologize for who he was. He said, this is who I am. Take me or leave me. And the world embraced him at that time for a long, long time. And I think that's what he was saying to George Michael. Like, yeah, you got a lot of fucked up problems, dude, but you better embrace it, because look at what you have. You have everything that you could possibly desire to deal with those problems. Now, is that the only way to handle this? No, it's not the only way to handle it. But I do believe, because a lot of things that I went through, because my mentor would have been in Frank Sinatra's. Well, my mentor was born 19 years after Frank Sinatra.
Okay.
Let's put it that way,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
And he's still old enough to be my grandfather.
Right.
Sometimes it was a bitch slap that woke me up. Instead
sure.
of long, complicated dissertation on why you should change or be grateful or whatever, it was kind of like, look, you know, you said you wanted this. Don't complain about what it's taking to get there, and you're going to have to make changes. And I told you that, and it's not like people don't know that today.
Yeah.
So when I saw it, that's what I kind of thought. Here was my original perspective on this. Frank knew enough to write the letter. That's what impressed me. Because you know me, I'm always wondering, like, these successful people, the people that I'll never get to interview Frank. He's not
right,
here anymore.
Right.
What did they think about success? Did they understand laws, rules? What was their mindset around it? What was going on? And this shows me he had some consciousness around those things. I don't know how much. I'm not going to pretend to know how much. But it shows that he did have some consciousness around
it. It's impressive, because he's not out of touch. Even as a 74-year-old man
right.
who's talking to this 27-year-old kid, let's be honest, 27 as a pop star, megastar, it's pretty impressive. But he's still a kid of sorts. He's in touch with that enough to be able to say, look, buddy, you can be doing better. So I get that piece totally, 100%. Yeah, he is definitely in touch.
Yeah, and how happening. Many people came into his life and kicked him in the ass? And
right.
they were like, you know, get it together. I mean, they're very famous time before he got the role in Here to Eternity. He was failing. He couldn't get a job anywhere.
Sure.
Nobody would hire him.
Yeah, and I know very little about Frank. I'm going to be honest with you. I need to dive into some of these biographies and kind of just understand a little bit. I mean, I know a little bit about his music background. I know his connections, his alleged connections and things like that. His Rat Pack days, but very little surface. Like I said, I was young, so I know more about George Michael, interestingly enough, than I do about Frank Sinatra.
Most people would today.
But I love that you brought that in there, because that is a letter I never would have saw had you not presented it on this podcast.
Yeah.
That's what I love about it, because you do such a deep dive, and I know you've been studying Frank Sinatra. I know you've been looking at greatness, and the fact that you brought it into this episode just it informed me a little bit, but it also got me on like high alert, thinking, who the hell is this guy who's airing his dirty laundry out in the newspaper?
Yeah, I am in the middle of another biography around him, which I'm sure that's why I attracted the letter, because I was not looking for a letter, you know.
Yeah.
It
yielded a Google search. I typed it in and boom, there it
totally
was.
Did.
I got a picture of that
yeah,
same thing.
Yeah,
you have
it,
in your
yeah,
hand.
It absolutely did. And I just think, you know, when I when I read a biography of somebody, I'm thinking to myself, what were they thinking? You know, so they take you, this one biography I'm reading, I'll tell everybody what it is in case they want to get it.
Yeah, totally. We can link in the show notes as well.
One second here. It's Sinatra. It is by James Kaplan, and it's the second version. So it covers his life from like 1951 till his death. There's another one before that I don't find is interesting. It's about his early days, you know, basically when he was just a total road warrior, you know, going from saloon to saloon singing. It's good. But the Sinatra that everybody knows is this Sinatra from this part of this book. So my thought was like, what is he thinking? You know, what is this guy thinking? Because he talks about the problems with all the women and the problems with JFK. And it's really, I mean, the guy goes into tremendous depth, and I'm thinking to myself, what's the makeup of Sinatra? What created this man? Because he was a deeply insecure person, very, very insecure individual. And yet he was one of the most charismatic people that the world has ever seen. Like, he was huge in his day. You know, and he had a great voice. I mean, you can't deny the voice,
totally.
Right?
There's no doubt about that.
You know, would he have been as charismatic without the voice? Probably not. But the way that he purported himself throughout his career, you can see where he did great things, and you could see where he did awful things. And there's another there's another biography that is not written, but it's actually on, I think it's on Amazon. And it's about the days that he spent, it's about Palm Desert. So his home was in Palm Desert from the 40s on till his death. Although he died in Beverly Hills, excuse me. But it's about all the people that knew him in Palm Springs. And how they talk about his light side and his dark side. On his light side, he was an unknown charitable giver. Like he would pick up the newspaper every day, see who needed help, and then just cut them anonymous checks. And he did this for people all over, no matter where he went. He just gave and gave and gave and gave and gave and gave. And
see, that context explains the letter to me more than anything else that I've been ranting
tell
about.
Tell me how.
Because now that I know he's a giver, I had this assumption of Frank Sinatra as being, it's funny, this is going to sound weird, but sort of like a bully. Like he was a part of the cool kids, right? The Rat Pack.
He was cool, though.
And a bully. Right. So, when I saw him coming down on little George Michael, I was thinking, God, he's being a bully. But then you just told me that he was giving and helpful, and he really gave of himself. That puts into context everything that's in that letter.
Yeah. And so he was very polarizing. He was a prick. And a bully, and he was one of the most nice. Like, sure. If you were his friend, you were his friend for life.
Yes.
If you were not, loyal. You were not for life. But everything that I've read says he was both of those people.
Yeah.
He was literally both of those people. But he could be the most giving person in the world, which creates, and he called himself an 18-carat manic depressive. I've read, I cannot tell you how many articles about him where he says, well, you know, I'm an 18-carat manic depressive.
What does that mean?
It means that he has huge swings, right? He has go from manic, his manic side, to his very depressed, isolated, virtually on the verge of suicide. And he two or three times he tried to commit suicide.
Wow, I did not know
in
that.
In his earlier years, yeah, he did. He had huge swings in his personality. And when the great side of it came out, he was the greatest. And when the worst came out, he was one of the worst. So it does explain. I think it does. It does lend to an explanation there.
So I was curious if they had done any sort of, because I've never really seen a movie about Frank or a documentary about Frank.
There are several.
And I just did a Google search, and there was one that was put on HBO about 5 years ago called All or Nothing at All.
Yes, it's fantastic. About four hours. Yeah,
would you recommend?
I would. Good.
Is that his entire life? Is it his later
life? His whole life.
They cover
the span of his whole life. Yeah, it's two parts.
Okay. I think I need to educate myself for sure, because he does exude cool, but maybe it's because I wasn't cool in 1990. Where when you were reading that letter, I was like, Jesus, this is
Well, if you want to see a great story about him in the cool years, watch the movie The Rat Pack. It came out on HBO with Ray Liotta, played him.
Got it.
It's a great movie. It's a great movie. And it really gives you Frank in that window there of JFK and what he went through.
Cool. What a cast.
Yeah. Oh, it's a great
Liotta,
cast.
Don Cheadle and Joe Mantegna.
Yeah.
William Peterson.
Yeah.
I love it.
It's great. It's a great movie.
Cool.
You probably have to watch it online because I don't even know if HBO has it anymore, but
yeah, definitely. Okay, well, that's That's good. I'm going to go ahead and pivot away from that. I love that we had a chance to talk about that. Let's talk a little bit about James Allen quick and As a Man Thinketh. And you specifically read from the title, you know, the chapter titled The Effect of Life on Circumstances, which is the title of this lovely podcast. And you read this quote. So thought and character are one, and as a character can only manifest and discover itself through environment and circumstance, the outer conditions of a person's life will always be found to be harmoniously related to his inner state, which is beautiful. Can you explain why that quote alone is something that should be studied and put up on your mirror and read every single day?
Because people think the world and life is happening to them. And I did for a long, long time. When you become self-aware, self-actualized, whatever you want to call it, you realize you're creating the problems that you have. And it's the greatest wake-up call ever, because then it's like, okay, now how do I change it? You become, at least the people that I've come in contact with, including myself, become inspired to change it. When I actually realized that I was not really stuck because anybody else or anything else was doing something to me, it was because of how I was thinking. And then I watched it change, it was like a whole new world opened up to me, a whole new enthusiasm for life, a whole new desire to see what it was that I could actually do. But it took a long time to get there. You know, I was 20, so that would be 24, 25, 26. It took about 27 years for me to have that wake-up call.
Wow.
But then everything changed. So here's the deal. In our mind, the way that our mind works, we literally have a cause and effect linked up inside of our brain. And we experience life as something that's happening to us, and we learn how to react to it. It takes a considerable amount of reading something like that over and over again, and then paying attention to your outside circumstances to actually see that break, to actually see that in your mind it break, and you go, oh, shit, I'm creating this. And he talks about in the book, pay attention to how your thought is creating your circumstance. How are they intricately connected? And I did that over and over and over and over again. And over a period of time, you can change all of it. But in that moment, if you don't have that awareness, you really do believe in your heart and soul that people around you and things around you need to change so that your life can get better. And it will never happen for anybody.
Right. You have to do it yourself.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And there's a couple things come out of that for me. You know, victims, they're just gross. Like being a victim in a situation and trying to point the finger everywhere but at yourself.
Right.
It's very easy to accept the great things that are happening in your life that, oh yeah, I'm creating this. But when shit gets off the rails or something gets difficult, then you start pointing the finger elsewhere. That's when you really need to check in internally and be like, okay, if I can accept the good, it's kind of like a football coach. When we're winning, everything's great.
Right.
The coach is like, yeah, I'm great. But when it's bad, he starts blaming his players.
Right.
Or the players start blaming the coach.
Right.
Right. So it's the same situation.
Or the field
here.
Or the ball
exactly.
Or the weather.
You have to accept it. You're the one creating it. And I think that quote in itself, I just love that whole, you know, situation where it's like, it's the inner state. It's the inner game. We always talk about the inner game on this podcast and in our company. You know, you talk about it's the inner game that you have to master, and you've done that, and you've clearly spread that message on this podcast and elsewhere. And it's cool to see you bring up James Allen, because we know that that book is something you use quite often in your own life.
And it's been a study since I got my hands on it. I mean, it is.
And it's just a little guy.
It's a little
but
book.
It's packed.
It's a little book. It's a little bit difficult to read based on the language that he uses. There's some words in there that most people don't use anymore. But if you just sit down and read a few pages a day, in a very short period of time, you'll start to actually create new brain cells. You know,
sure.
You will create new neural pathways based on how he's telling you to look at your thought process versus what you have in your life.
Well, and I'd like to think that people that are watching this and listening to this podcast probably know someone in their life who is a complainer, and it very well could be their parents. It could be a brother, it could be a sister, it could be an aunt, an uncle, whatever it might be. And then they start to take a hard look at themselves and realize, oh, I kind of do that too. That makes sense, because obviously they were reared by their parents, or they were raised by an aunt and uncle or a grandparent, whatever it might be. So, you know, I think what I loved about this lesson so much was it centers around gratitude. Even the letter from, you know, from Frank to George was all about gratitude. Be grateful for what you have, man. Be grateful every single day. And when you complain, you sort of expect you can expect to create a miserable experience. If you're a complainer, you just keep bringing in all that bad stuff. But when you show gratitude or shift that to gratitude, even in the most difficult of times, which is sometimes hard, but it's manageable, you expect to create a more impactful life. So knowing all of that, why do you think there are so many complainers out there? I've got a theory, but I want to hear yours first.
Well, first of all, I think it's a habit. Our mind works based on habit, right? So it links up habits and patterns. And if we're raised around people that are complaining, I was raised around people that were complaining all the time. And for a while I complained. It becomes the outward expression of how you're seeing your world, right? It's an external representation of what's going on in our own mind, right? We're complaining because we don't think we have any control over everything, and everybody else does it. It's also a bonding experience. It's the water cool experience.
It's the working as an elementary school teacher experience. 100%. Everybody's just bitching.
Yeah. So like if everybody in the workplace is complaining, if you're like Mr. Positive, you know, you're the dick in the group. Nobody wants to listen to Mr. Positive when everybody's complaining. So you want to be part of the group. So people, even if you don't feel like you want to complain, you complain because that's how everybody else is seeing the world at that time.
Yeah. And if you are in that, you know, MO where you are complaining, but you don't agree with it, but even nodding the head and participating, you're letting all that stuff in, all that energy's coming in, and it's going to be expressed in all crazy ways around the shit you're going to create in your life.
It is. And here's another thing. If I'm in a group of people and they're all complaining, for me to do something different, I would have to become confrontational. And so many people do not like confrontation that they won't do something. Now, there's another perspective on this. In most of those groups of people, if you become Mr. Positive, you're not going to change anything. You're just going to, things are going to get defensive. So what generally happens is that most people realize at some point they're not going to change the complainers, and they just remove themselves from those groups of individuals. You know, yeah. I remember Proctor used to say that he was hanging out in the bar when he was younger, and he was sitting around and he was holding up a glass, and apparently he was doing a lot of drinking in these days. And he looked around at the people in the bar and he was like, they're all bums in here. And then he was like, holy shit, if they're bums, what does that say about me? So he put down the glass and he never went back to the bar. And he's like, I don't even think they know I left. And when he said that to me, I was going through a process of starting to weed out friends that were not beneficial in my life. And I thought to myself, and he said that, I don't think they know I left. And I thought to myself, you know something? I'll bet you they don't know I left. Like, they know I left because I'm not physically there anymore. But the embodiment of what I represented to those individuals didn't make a dent in their life whatsoever. Because if it did, they would have changed. And that was a huge wake up for me. Like, they didn't know I left. If you left my life or Steph left my life, there would be a hole there, right? There would be a significant hole there. It would have really meant something. And a lot of people that I have in my life. Sure. But in those days, I don't think it meant. You know, like people just, you know.
Yeah, interesting. Well, my theory around the whole complainers and why there's so many of them is just because it's easy. It's just easy to blame everyone else and point the finger elsewhere than point it at yourself. Because, you know, getting back to the looking glass, which I'll have here in a moment, when you stare in that mirror and you see what's staring back at you, and you have to point the finger and say, I screwed up, I need to make amends for this.
Yeah.
That's when it really becomes real. And most people will just complain and bitch and moan, and it's always something external. And if you've got those people in your life, it's hard to leave them. Well, I shouldn't say it's hard to leave them behind. It's really just a decision, but there will be a connection. And once you sever that, you're a lot better off.
You got to swing, baby.
You got to
let off those gossamer wings, you know, fly.
I got to Google that. all right. So another quote, and we'll kind of wind it down with this one. And you've said this quote many times in your teaching. You've said it on the podcast and you've read it many, many times. And it's the mind is the master power that molds and makes, and man is mind, and evermore he takes. The tool of thought and shaping what he wills brings forth 1,000 joys, 1,000 ills. He thinks in secret and it comes to pass. Environment is but his looking glass. So I want you to take us back to when you first heard that, or you first read that, were first introduced to that, and you had to look up the word looking glass to decipher it. I love that piece. Can you share maybe what switch that flipped in you and how it has guided you through this exceptionally amazing career?
Well, the first time it didn't. I mean, I I was in my car listening to books on tape. And the way that I was finding out about these books was the author, whoever I was listening to, would mention a book that he read or she read. And then I would go immediately and get that book. And that's how I found As a Man Thinketh. And I got down and I sat down and I started to read it. And I read that poem in the beginning. And I thought, there's a truth there that I don't understand. It's interesting. And, you know, Billy Graham mentioned this once. He said, when you hear the truth and you deny it, it leaves deep emotional scars. And I remember the first time I heard that, and I thought to myself, you know, there's something that is very honest about that, because I think we know the truth when we hear it. Whether we admit it or not, we might get defensive, it might make us angry, we might get triggered. There's something about the truth that resonates inside of us, and I think it resonates with our higher side of ourself, and it contradicts the side of ourself that's made up as we go through time. So when I came across this book, I knew that there was tremendous truth in it, but I didn't have the correlations created yet. So I started going through it, and my mentor told me a story that I thought was very profound. And I think this is what gave me the significance of how much power was actually in this book. And I heard this very early on. So I'll tell you the story. So Proctor made a mistake in his business, and he had a really big loss. I'm not going to say what it was, but it was a huge loss. He was devastated. And he was living on Maplewood Lane in Glenview, Illinois. And he went home and he literally sat in the living room with the lights off for like a month. He just was like, he was devastated. It devastated him. I think it caught him unawares, and he just didn't know if he wanted to continue. And he took, apparently, Earl Nightingale had a condensed narration of this book on album. Wow. He got the book on album, right, on 78 vinyl, or 33 and a half vinyl, and he started listening to it. And within a couple of weeks, he sat down and he wrote his lifelong goal down, and that he would have a global, a company that operated all over the world. And he didn't have anything. He lost everything at the time. So what he did was that he went out and bought a Cadillac. And he didn't have any way to pay for it, but he thought, well, now I got something I have to pay for. I better figure out how to pay for this. And he said, but at least it made him feel good to drive it around every day. But when I heard him tell the story, what it did for him was it made him realize that he was in some kind of a blame mode, and he took back responsibility for whatever the mistake was, and he was able to turn it around. So I was like, that there's a lot of power in there to change a person's thinking just by listening to that book. And then I really got into it deeper, and I used to teach it to masterminds and, sure, you know, all different kinds of things.
I would love to get my hands on that vinyl. That would be so
cool. Oh, yeah,
cool,
seriously.
I mean,
right?
That's got to be a rare item,
yeah,
right there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm sure it is.
Any of those old school, like, high level thinking type
albums. Well, we
have
that one. We have one on the wall. We have Earl Nightingale's Strangest Secret in vinyl.
We break that baby out of that case and let it rip. That's so cool. I love that. All right. Well, let's finish off. I've got to bring it back to my new best friend, Frank Sinatra. Please do not blast me on YouTube and the socials around Frank Sinatra.
Oh, you're going to have a ton of people agree with you. They're going to want to be jumped. They're going to want to save you.
But I know there's also a lot of people going to be like, oh my God, get it straight. Frank Sinatra's a god. And he's beautiful. A beautiful voice, wonderful actor. I'm going to do a deep dive. I'm going to listen to the autobiography or the biography. Yeah. I'm going to go through all of it. I want to learn more about it because he does exude cool to me. But in his letter, the last paragraph to George Michael that was published was, talent must not be wasted. And then condensing here, those who have it must hug it, embrace it, nurture it, and share it, lest it be taken away from you as fast as it was loaned to you. And that is the honest to God's truth. So broad strokes here, what can the listener do today to maximize their talent moving forward and trust that it is
It's very talent? Simple. Whatever you don't lose, whatever you don't use, you lose. That's it. That's it. That's what he's saying. That's basically what Sinatra's telling him. And he tells him at the end of that, he says, trust me, I've been there. Yeah. And he did. If you read the biography, there was a time where he went into self-pity for himself. And he was so broken over his breakup with Ava Gardner, and like he was just shitting all over himself. And all of a sudden, nobody wanted him. Wow. He couldn't get a job anywhere. And he was the greatest singer in the world, a year or two before that. And he couldn't get a job to save his life.
I'd be curious who gave him the ass kicking that he clearly gave George Michael.
I don't know.
I would love to know.
I haven't heard that yet.
Because you know he probably picked himself up as well.
I think it was Ava. I think it was Ava that saved him. Yeah, according to the story, there's two versions of this story. One is that the Godfather story is true, that the mob went and got him to roll it here to eternity. The other story is that Ava knew the producer, and she was the one that got him the role on there. Anyway, he won an Oscar for that role, and it put him back on top of the world again. And then he realized, don't ever do that again.
Yeah.
Don't ever let
ben
it down
Rock
again.
Bottom, not going
and he kept
again.
Working the rest of his life.
I love that. Well, this has been fun. I really enjoyed this a great deal. Thank you for educating me about
absolutely.
This. I feel great
absolutely.
About it. And thanks for coming inside.
You got it.
Thanks for listening to the Successful Mind podcast. And if you like what you heard and you want to know more, go to davidnagel.com/freestuff.